Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and welcome to another edition of Looking at the World of Wildlife in Wisconsin with Scott Craven back in the studio. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist within the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW. Great to have him along to talk about what's going on in wildlife and certainly to answer your questions. Comments, concerns, maybe you have a story to share. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. We already have a photo or two up on our Facebook page. You don't have to be a member of Facebook to look at those photos. Just go to Facebook, and the title of our page is The Larry Mueller Show. So you can go there. Join if you'd like. We'd love to have you join, but you don't have to be a member of Facebook in order to see those photos. And if you've got a wildlife photo to share, I hope you will share it with us. And Scott, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
It's great to be back. It's a terrific time of year to be outdoors and interested in wildlife.
Yeah, man, all the rain we've had, do you think that's had any effect on wildlife?
It certainly had an effect on the mosquito population.
Yeah.
I don't ever remember seeing the growth as lush and green as it is right now this time of year, as evidenced by the fact that my lawn seems to need attention about every 3 or 4 days. So
yeah.
The woods are just thick with growth. So there seem to be good crops of just about everything out there. The blackberry crop was big. My garden's overrun. The weeds are almost impossible to keep under control. It's been so wet. So generally, habitat conditions are pretty good, and for things that need or want water, from amphibians to waterfowl, there's plenty of it out there on the landscape.
Speaking of amphibians, you've got a great story to tell. We have a photo of Mr. Bullfrog. Tell us that story. I love it.
Well, I've got a little water garden in the backyard with a little waterfall. It's only maybe, I don't know, 12 feet long and 3 or 4 feet wide, but just a water feature for some interest in the garden. And over the years, I'm interested in herpetiles, so I keep track of who's out there singing or breeding or just hanging out. And with a dozen species of frogs and toads in the state, I was wondering, gee, what can I expect here? Because we're not exactly near anything. We're up on high ground in the middle of 12 acres of restored prairie, which can't be easy for anything to get through. But nevertheless, over the years, I've recorded 7 species of frogs, 6 frogs and toads, in that little pond. And some of them are pretty regular visitors. But this year, about 6 or 7 weeks ago, all of a sudden, gee, there's an unusually big frog in the pond. And we've had some pretty good-sized green frogs in the past, but I looked at him and said, that doesn't look like a green frog. And anyway, it's a bullfrog, and I have no idea
how the heck
that bullfrog got there, but he's there, and he's been there every day. He disappears occasionally for a day or two at a time. I think it's just a matter of not seeing him in the vegetation. But he sits there, and he's become pretty acclimated to either the grandkids or me or Candy going down to have a look at him. And, a week or 10 days ago, because we need to feed him. He's not getting enough to eat. And so, I don't know about that, but I had some night crawlers left from a fishing trip, so I draped a night crawler over a stick, and I knew from catching them in the past that anything moves near a bullfrog, he's on it. They're about as carnivorous and voracious as any animal I know of. So anyway, the frog kind of eyed up the worm and launched himself probably a good foot out of the water and grabbed the worm and the stick and wrestled it away from me. And hey, that was pretty cool. So we've been doing that now daily, sometimes several times a day. And the frog's gotten used to it, so now when he sees us coming, he orients toward us. And if he's on the other side of the pond, all they have to do is tap the water surface with a stick, and he swims right over and sits there waiting for a worm. And we've got some pretty interesting video, which I had hoped we could post, but we'll figure out a way to get it up there eventually, of this pretty good-sized bullfrog launching himself up to grab a worm. He's almost at the point where he'll take it from my fingers, but it's kind of hard to hold steady when the frog's coming at you with that big mouth open.
We do have a nice photo of
him. So there is a nice still photo of him. And like I say, he's just kind of sitting there. And the mystery, of course, is where the heck did that frog come from? How did he get in this little pond and a long way from any amphibian habitat? But bullfrogs are not a common species in any event. So that's part of it. But I think the other thing, the relevance for folks who are contemplating anything from a water garden to a food plot to any kind of habitat improvement around their homes or rural properties is that you just don't know what to expect. Not only will you get the likely suspects, but you may attract some fairly unusual stuff. And it's, we've used the expression before, like the field of dreams. If you build it, they will come. And if you create some habitat for these animals, they have a way of getting there. And it's kind of rewarding and interesting for people thinking about doing that.
So if you want to see a photo of the Craven bullfrog, go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mealer Show. Hopefully we'll figure out a way to get that video up as well. John in Elk Mound has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Good morning. I was just driving between Chippewa Falls and Elk Mound, and I saw two sand hills out in the field, and it appeared to be a whooping crane with them. It was slightly bigger than the two sand hills. I live in that area, and I've never seen a whooping crane around. Are they beginning to migrate or move, do they hang out with the sand hills? Like, are they, nursed or taken care of?
No, they wouldn't be. Well, there are parts of the country where sand hills have been used as surrogates for attempting to work with whooping crane restoration. But most of the efforts to restore whooping cranes here have centered on releasing captive birds, and then they were part of this operation migration opportunity to lead them in migration with ultralights down to the wildlife refuge on the west coast of Florida, where they spent the winter and then returned. And that has recently been discontinued, but the bottom line is the cranes were successfully reestablished, and there are quite reasonable numbers of them now around Wisconsin. So it's certainly quite possible that you saw one. Whether it was why it was with the sandhills is perhaps another matter. But I would think that would be, they're still scarce enough that that's something worth reporting to your local DNR wildlife manager so that they can run it up the flagpole to the folks who might be concerned.
Or even post it on eBird.
Sure.
Yeah, I just drove by there. It's right by Five Star Dairy on Highway 29, right out by off of 29. So if somebody's driving, they might want to check
it out.
There's
a chance to have a look.
Yeah, yep. Thank you, John.
But in addition, the answer to your question, are things moving around? A lot of things are starting to move around and aggregate from flocks of blackbirds and swallows, and some of these things will be moving out fairly quickly, and the cranes will be gathering. And just in the last week or so, I've noticed lots of egrets around, too, in some of the shallow wetlands. So things will be congregating, and as the leaves begin to fall, they'll become more visible.
Yeah, we just talked about migration with Bill Volkert and Tom Schultz on Labor Day. We had that little discussion. So, and thanks again, John, for calling. Appreciate it. I'm thinking about big, large birds here in the state. The trumpeter swan recovery has been great, hasn't it?
Well, it's been terrific, and it points to the fact that there are quite a few success stories when it comes to birds that when I started here in the 70s with the as a grad student and then went on the faculty in 79, there was all sorts of concern over things like bald eagles, trumpeter swans, peregrine falcons, loons, and a whole host of things. And in fact, most of those birds now, with the help of human intervention through sound wildlife management and efforts by our state and federal agencies, are in pretty darn good shape. And in the case of the trumpeter swans, in 1989, zero. And now the population estimate is somewhere around just over 5,000 in Wisconsin.
And so that's a short period of time, you think about it.
In the terms of, geological time or whatever, it's the blink of an eye. So that's really quite an amazing recovery. But there are many other species that go on that list of recoveries as well. And as you recall, that one got started when biologists from the DNR started flying up to Alaska with the help of some corporate sponsors here in Wisconsin and collecting swan eggs, bringing them back, and with a cooperative effort with the Milwaukee Museum and others, or the zoo rather, and others, the swans were raised and they were fostered out, and I mean, the rest is history. Yeah. They're doing very well.
Well, here's Mary Ann from one of my favorite areas, the Turtle Flambeau Flowage. Hi, Mary Ann.
Well, hi. I'm glad I could ask Scott this question. I've lived on the flowage for many, many years, and I do the mowing. I have about an acre and a half of mowing. And last year in July, these little tiny frogs appeared. They're not frogs. They're like toads. Mm-hmm. So I'm asking all around, does anybody know what these are? Nobody seems to know. And they're like a brown, and then some are like reddish color. And again, they appeared again in the end of July and the beginning of August. And of course, we've had a lot of rain. Have you heard about this, Scott?
Yes, I witness the same thing in my backyard every year. They are toads. We only have the one species of toad in the state, American toads, and every little body of water will have toads breeding in it in the spring. The result are just masses of tiny black tadpoles. Those are produced by the toads, and then those eventually metamorphose into these little toadlets, as they're called, or emerging essentially baby toads. And that all happens relatively synchronously over a period of time, depending on the weather. And then all of a sudden, these thousands, or in some cases millions, of little toads disperse throughout the landscape to repopulate the system. The adults have long since gone back to wherever they came from, but the toadlets then spread out along the landscape. Most of them do not survive. If they did, we'd be up to our waist in toads before too long. But that's really all it is the seasonal emergence of these newly metamorphosed toads from the breeding ponds into their terrestrial toad form, and away they go, hopefully to live a long and happy life as toads.
There we go.
And the same thing happens with the other frog species as well. It's just not as obvious as it may be. It can be very obvious with a big population of leopard frogs, but with most other species, some which never leave the water, you don't really notice the migration as you do with toads.
Well, thank you much.
And are you a musky fisherman, Mary Ann?
I don't fish anymore at all.
Okay, just wondered.
I leave it for all the other people.
Okay, there you go. We had caught many muskies on the Turtle Flambeau Flowage. That's a wonderful place to fish. Thanks again for calling. Ruth in Oregon, your turn. Hi, Ruth.
Oh, good morning, Scott and Larry. I have a question about an animal I saw about a month ago. I live on a small horse farm in the town of Oregon, and I looked out and saw this animal coming up along a fence line, and at first it looked very much like a fox. It was the size and shape of a fox. It moved like a fox, but it was a very different color. It was kind of the color of a doe. It didn't have a bushy tail. It didn't have a thick coat. And it hopped through the pasture gate, came across the lawn, went under the deck, and then we lost sight of him. But we saw him an hour or so later, and my son had arrived, and he thought it was a young coyote, but I disagreed. So, do you have any idea what this might have been?
That's kind of your neck of the woods there, Scott.
Well, I also live in the town of Oregon, so we may be neighbors.
Yeah,
but,
I live around the corner from you.
Okay.
On Storytown.
Oh, okay. Well, there are three possibilities. In the summer, a red fox can look not like most people's vision of a red fox. They get their hair is much thinner. It's not prime as it would be described in the fur trade. And they look pretty darn skinny and ratty looking, especially a younger one. So did you see it close enough to see what the color of the tip of its tail was?
I didn't.
Okay.
I mean, my impression was it was just uniformly this light beige color, you know, like a doe.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say initially a more slender, much thinner furred fox is a gray fox, but generally they are they're a beautiful animal with kind of rusty extremities and a generally a gray coat. So I think you would have noticed that. So if you're describing it as fawn colored, then I still think the best bet is just a young or not very well furred red fox.
What about the tip of the
coyote,
tail?
The tip of the tail on a red fox is white. It's black on a gray fox, and it's uniform on a coyote. But a coyote's quite a bit more a more sizable animal than a fox is.
Yeah. And I mean, my first impression was this just looked very fox-like.
Well, yeah. Then I think if it looked like a fox and smelled like a fox, it was probably a fox.
There you go. Thank you, Ruth, for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Right now, taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, retired UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Great to have him along, and thanks for listening. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. If you want to take a look at Scott's bullfrog, you can go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And maybe you've got one of your own photos that you want to share, wildlife photos. Love to see that as well on the Larry Mueller Show website. So our Facebook page, I'm sorry. Tim in North Freedom has a question. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Larry and Scott. I retired, it'll be 3 summers ago, and I ride bike a lot, every day, 5, 10, 15 miles, out in the west end of the Baraboo Valley, and I have not seen or heard a meadowlark. Are they endangered or on the wane as the red-headed woodpecker has been?
They're kind of in the same category with the red-headed woodpecker. I mean, a number of birds have opened spaces like that and in a prairie and grassland habitats. Have been on the wane for a number of years, and meadowlarks fall into that category. And since you brought it up, I guess I haven't seen a meadowlark all summer either, but I'm not in the environment for it as much as you apparently are. So, yes, they have, they've been a bird of some concern, and if you want to track that population decline in terms of the current situation, you can find those trends on eBird, the website that Larry mentioned a couple moments ago, and actually see what the numbers say. But your observation is correct. They don't seem to be nearly as common as they once were.
It's just too bad.
Which is. They're very,
love
especially
to hear their
song.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. On to Sarah in Lafarge. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning, guys. I just wanted to share a really neat experience that I have had. I am fortunate enough to be raised in the South and then moved to Wisconsin, so I've had the best of both worlds. And I live in the Kickapoo Valley Reserve area out in Driftless. Anyway, I had never seen a bald eagle in person until I was about 33 or so years old, and we moved here. And this spring, my husband bought me a kayak for my birthday, which is absolutely the best present you can get. And while going down the Kickapoo on my very first outing, I was fortunate enough to have an eagle that kept showing up and flying above me. And then as it was almost time to get off the river, he sat on a branch right over the river, and it was really low, and my kayak passed right underneath him, and he didn't move. He watched me go underneath him, and it was actually a little bit scary because they're much more intimidating when you're that close to them, but it's not something that I will ever forget. So I'm glad that they're back here. So just wanted to share that.
Thanks a lot. And
that's a good story.
And being on a kayak, you do get a chance to see things that you might not normally see. But although eagles now, you're going to see a lot of eagles here in the state of Wisconsin. But that's a great story. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it very much. I like to get out on the kayak, too, once in a while. And it is a lot of fun sitting low in the water. Judy in Prairie du Sac, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My question is this. In late summer here in Prairie du Sac out in the country, we've been seeing lots of tiny smooth, limey green tree frogs.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a black line through their eye on each side.
Yep.
And no modeling at all. And they'll be sitting on green leaves, so they kind of blend in. I've never seen a bigger one. What are they?
They're green tree frogs.
they
are tree frogs, but technically they're gray tree frogs. And if you took that lime green guy, there are two species, and one is more likely to be the lime green color face by the other, but they can change very quickly.
So okay.
if you took one and just put it in a terrarium for a little while with some, you know, bark or landscape mulch or whatever, it would in all probability within a very reasonable length of time become mottled gray.
Really?
To match the camouflage. But they are tree frogs. They're reasonably tame. I'm not sure where you're seeing them. In my case, they line up on the upper part of my garage door every night on a humid night underneath the sodium light and
just sit there
all night long waiting for bugs to get close enough to them. And they also seem to like my raspberry patch, too,
because
I'll find them sitting there when I'm picking berries. But they're quite common, and this kind of warm, humid, very moist weather has been very good for them.
So eventually they'll grow bigger then, too,
right? Well, if you've seen the small ones, I would say some of the adults that I have are... some are as big when they're sitting flat, as big around as a silver dollar. But that's about as big as they'll get. Most are probably more likely quarter size.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Judy, for calling. And Jeff in Fox Lake, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Say, I have a question regarding the specifics of barn swallows. I milk in an old-style dairy barn, and in the summer, every year we have returns, and usually have 5-6 pairs. They actually nest right in the barn. And now they left last week. I was wondering specifically where they go and what would a life expectancy be on a small bird like that?
Mm-hmm. As far as where they go, all the way down through Central and into South America, so they cover a lot of ground. As far as life expectancy is concerned, obviously some of them make it back from their wintering grounds to breed again next year. So, you know, this is guesswork on my part, but
3 years?
2-3 years, maybe a lucky old one, maybe 4 or 5, but basically that population cycles pretty quickly. If you, you know, you can, there are a number of good bird books. The Birder's Handbook, for example, is one, and there's also some life history information in this eBird site, or the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, which if you can just get a hold of a copy of that or have someone photocopy for you the section on barn swallows, since you seem to have a keen interest in them, that will give you a very good picture of their distribution in Wisconsin, where they are in the off season when they're not here, and I think we'll probably have some comments about their lifespan as well.
Would you have, you know, they're only going to live 2-3 years at the most. Would the young be coming back?
The young would come back.
Yeah, so that's why.
So that's why it, you know, in a favored barn or a bridge or something like that, that population just keeps cycling through older individuals and young ones that are coming back to their natal area.
Yes, if you have time, I have a really interesting story. They usually run 2 batches a year, almost always, regardless of the weather. And this last batch was getting very late. There was 3, and I thought, oh, they're never going to make it. They're not off the nest yet. And I don't think they were out of that nest maybe 2-3 days before the whole lot of them went. They were, and them little guys learned to fly, and like 2-3 days later, they don't tell you when they're going to leave. You just notice that,
they're gone.
They're gone.
They're gone.
Yep.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly a bird that is hatched as a young bird is capable of flying. It could be 10 days. I think as little as 10 days, and up to longer, but 10 days, that's an amazing feat to me, anyway.
Yeah, I think with rough grouse, for example, it's only a little, really handful of days.
Yeah, just so. five or six days.
Yep.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thank you.
We have Angela in Rome next. Hi, Angela.
Hey, Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
Scott, Larry. I enjoy your show, Larry. But, Scott, I want to make a comment with regard to the gentleman who thought he saw a whooping crane with Susanto.
Yeah.
I may very well know this this group of cranes. I live in the area. We have two wild nesting pairs of whooping cranes that I won't disclose their location. I was out checking on my little bird friends, and Crane Foundation gentleman was there. He was tracking this whooping crane who likes his sandhill friends. They're not ideal to be hanging out with the sandhills, but I did notice they've departed from our area, so I'm hoping that they're well on their way to their warmer climate.
Excellent.
And the toad comment, I do have a dollar-sized gray tree frog that's living on the lip of our hot tub this year.
That's a good spot.
He loved it. I thought, well, you don't want to be by those chemicals. I re-sorted it a few times, and he comes back, so he seems perfectly happy.
Well, a more hazardous location that they seem to frequent at my house, and I suspect at others too, is under the grill cover or the grill lid itself in a gas grill. There, people should, watch out for that. Before, make sure you open the lid, look around a little bit for tree frogs or a variety of other things before you go ahead and fire up that gas grill.
There you go.
I certainly will do that because the grill's not far from the hot tub.
There you go. Thanks, Angela.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing. All right, Dennis in Berlin, thank you for calling.
Hi. Last weekend, we're in the Pembine area, and we observed a doe. She did not have a fawn with her, but she still had a very large udder. Is it possible she's still nursing a fawn?
Sure. The distribution of fawn drop is a normal distribution, a bell curve, so to speak, that over the years, I think the earliest report, and it was on the radio program years ago when someone called from Maple Bluff in April and had a couple of fawns in her tulip bed. So the fawn drop can begin in early spring, usually peaks out somewhere around early June, depending on where you are in the state. But there are still fawns being dropped, well into August or potentially even early September. So it's quite possible that the doe was still nursing, or, of course, unfortunately, it's possible she had been nursing and may have lost the fawn. Who knows?
Hmm. All right. I'd never seen that before, so...
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Dennis, for calling.
Great.
Yeah, appreciate it. We have Rusty in Stevens Point up next. Hi, Rusty.
Hey, hello. Thanks for taking the call. I got some a little business out off of the Wisconsin River, and every year this time we get the snapping turtle hatch.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have a light over the front of my building, and I'm not sure if that's an attractant, but like last night we had about a dozen little snapping turtles hanging around the front door. There's a road that kind of goes through, and I don't want them to get run over. I don't want to bother them either. But I pick them up and I take them over and put them closer to the riverbank.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a problem or is that okay? I don't want to hurt, disturb them.
That is one lucky turtle.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can imagine the hazards of a snapping turtle young that's at best quarter sized and is only built about an eighth of an inch from the ground, that's a pretty dangerous trek to get from wherever the nest was, which is probably in your yard, to the river, lake, or whatever. So, there can be 40 or 50 of those little guys from a nest. If you find the nest or a concentration of them, there's no harm in putting them in a pail and taking them to the nearest water or wherever they seem to be headed and releasing them again. That's entirely up to you, but helping them along a little bit is just good human nature.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, I wanted to make sure I wasn't disturbing him somehow, that it would be detrimental. Secondly, where I live, I've got heavier clay to the west by Rudolph. I don't see night crawlers anymore. We used to be able to go out and pick, hundreds of them, and there's none around. I don't spray any kind of chemicals or anything on my lawn. I haven't really changed anything, but I've noticed over the last couple of years, we just don't have the night crawlers. Is there something going on?
Not that I know of. You know, it's been such a wet year that I've been able to catch night crawlers just about any night in my garden. I know you pick them with a flashlight and all, and since they now sell at the bait shops for about $3.50 a dozen, it's like picking up quarters in the yard. So sometimes I collect them even when I don't need them. But now that I'm feeding the bullfrog, I'm in more need for night crawlers than normal. You know, soil type certainly has a lot to do with it. Particularly heavy clays or sandy soil and aren't particularly good for their burrow formation, but I don't know of anything that's been affecting the night crawlers in any negative way. So, I mean, in some cases it may have been just so wet that in clay that gets heavily saturated that they essentially
killed them off.
That's just a possibility. I can't say that that's fact, but a little speculation.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks, Rusty. Dave in Deerfield. Hello. Thanks for calling.
Hi. This is a good you were on here. I was just in my car out here by Deerfield heading over here to Cambridge to do some errands and stuff. And I saw a turkey, somewhere younger, a young one with the parents, I guess. And one was quite a bit smaller, like one-third the size. Would that be like a runt of the litter, or did some of them hatch later, or did she pick up an orphan or something? What do you think about that?
Well, those are all possibilities. I mean, there could have been one that was, for whatever genetic reason, a bit smaller, but it's also possible this time of year when there are lots of broods running around and some of them are getting pretty big, some of the older, more experienced hens may very well collect some of the young from other hens. So it is possible that that poor little guy that you saw was the only survivor of a brood or who knows what, but attached to the other family unit.
Yeah, that's just an observation. The one was so much smaller, it was really odd almost. Okay, I guess I think
that's the most likely explanation.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I thank you for your...
Sure.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Thinking about mothering, and Canada geese often will... you'll get a couple, three Canada geese together, adults, and they'll have three or four, five batches.
It's called gang brooding, and sometimes the more, of course, Canada geese live for a long time, and the more experienced females will collect the broods of some of the younger ones that haven't quite caught on yet, and all of a sudden you'll see a brood of 25 or 30 young Canada geese. Says, what the heck is going on here? But that's perfectly normal.
Judy, in Lodi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. We just came back last night from up by Hiles, Wisconsin, and in the lake, Pine Lake, there were two beautiful, or the day before, I'm sorry, white trumpeters. And then there was one that was darker. And it seemed like it tried to get between the two that were, they looked like they were mated, Don't they mate for life?
They do. But a darker one would be a youngster. Yeah, the youngsters are kind of a sooty. Well, not really. Well, they look dirty, kind of grayish.
Yeah, that's what this one was.
Yeah,
like.
that was mom and dad with a youngster.
Well, then why didn't he fly off when they flew off?
He may not be able to fly yet, depending on when the hatch was. It's getting a little late for that, but that I can't tell you. Explaining, why wildlife, birds, mammals, or anything else do some of the things they do is always a little tricky, but...
Just like a human.
Yes, very much so. And those two adults may have been coming back. The young one couldn't fly.
There was two eagles that were soaring around that area where they were flying. They were in the middle of the lake, and we couldn't do anything about it. My daughter was in her kayak, and she came back... told us, look, but we already were looking.
Well, I think you have to assume that that young one was big enough to take care of itself and that the parents probably weren't too far away. So,
yeah,
hopefully
they were beautiful.
They are very pretty.
Yeah. Thanks, Judy.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. And we have Jim in Elk Mound next. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I'm looking at those cranes right now.
Okay.
and they're starting to fly toward me, and they're jumping up and down too. The white one has black on the end of its wings.
Yep.
Heavy contrast, but the two other ones, they could be sandhills. We've seen quite a few of those around here, but are the younger whoopers darker color? They seem to have black wingtips on them, too, or starting to form them anyhow.
The younger whoopers are often kind of a rusty color. Much like the swans are gray, the young whoopers are a little on the rusty side, but depending on when they were hatched, they should be getting along pretty good, too.
Yeah, where they were in flight.
They were flying.
From where I was first seen, and they flew actually right toward where I'm sitting on the side of the road in the car. And they are able to fly, but they are considerably smaller than the white ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to think if you're looking at those same birds, the first caller seemed pretty certain that what he was looking at was a pair of sandhills with one whooper tagging along. So I can't say for sure, but that sounds like the most plausible explanation.
Yeah,
sure.
All right.
Yeah, well, I heard it on the radio.
And there you were.
Just heading home, and I thought, well, I'll go swing by there and see if they're there.
That's pretty
and
cool.
There they are.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jim.
For the program.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. By the way, you can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Larry Mueller here with Scott Craven. Tim in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I'm wondering about the status of bats in northern Wisconsin. I have a cabin just across the border in the UP, and we seem to be seeing a lot less bats this year.
Well, there are a variety of explanations, but the two big issues with bats right now, of course, the fact that 2 years ago white nose syndrome finally made it to Wisconsin, and as a result, all of our cave bats are now considered a threatened species, and you know, we're looking at the potential for some significant mortality here in Wisconsin for common bat species like little browns, big browns, and so on, maybe approaching a majority of the bats in a given hibernaculum. I want to say 14, but I'm not sure about that, but a number of the major hibernacula have either been determined to be infected or some of the larger ones are threatened, particularly the feared mortality that may occur at the Neda mine site in east central Wisconsin, which is a very large hibernaculum, perhaps several hundred thousand bats. So that the upshot of it was where this was first discovered in the Northeast and is now spread throughout a big chunk of the country, pretty substantial mortality has occurred, and that would be expected to be reflected in everything from household colonies to colonies using bat houses that people have put out, because the mortality occurs after the bats have left those sites and concentrated at the hibernacula for the winter where the mortality occurs. So it's possible that your observations are related to that. White nose syndrome now found in 27 states and 5 Canadian provinces and all the way to the Pacific Northwest. So this will be an ongoing big problem for bat conservation. Now, for people who have them in a cabin, and we're perhaps concerned more about, gee, how the heck do we get them out of the cabin, then, you know, your problems may have been solved by other factors. So that's really the situation, the most likely explanation for seeing declines, but it's also possible that other things are going on in terms of, you know, they found a more suitable roost site, or someone's excluded them from a roost site, or whatever.
Yeah.
But as long as you brought up the bat situation, that's an opportune time to mention something I wanted to alert people to. And that's the upcoming 2016 Wisconsin Bat Festival, which this year will be held October 1st at the Milwaukee Public Museum on the 1st from 9 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon. And the bat folks through the conservation program at the DNR are thrilled about being in Milwaukee and hoping for a large crowd. Past festivals were right here in Madison, Larry. Mm-hmm. We used to plug those every year and usually attracted anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 people. There's the potential to attract even more in Milwaukee. So if you're interested in bats and either in the Milwaukee area or willing to head over there, there are usually all sorts of things as part of the Bat Festival, including live bat programs, chance to interact with the scientists and agency representatives, educational bat programs, bat house building workshops, all sorts of other things. So it's...
What's the date again?
October 1st.
October 1st.
October 1st. And, well, there's another, in the announcement that I have here, there's another opportunity that on September 30th at the Urban Ecology Center, the Menominee Valley branch, they'll be hosting a Superheroes of the Night demonstration on September 30th before the Bat Festival the next day. So anyway,
cool.
Quite a few things going on. You could go to the DNR's website and look at the Bat, click on the Bat program and get the details of that Bat Festival. But that's a positive thing on bats. The white nose syndrome and the loss of potentially a lot of bats is a lot less positive.
Scott Craven, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening here on the Ideas Network as we talk the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Wildlife, Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and with the UW Extension, of course, as well. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Give a call or post a photo. If you got a good wildlife photo, post it up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can also post questions there as well. Jim in Camp Douglas has a question. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Larry. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Yeah, I work at a local golf course, and we came to work Monday. And on one of the side hills, there were five holes, fresh holes had been dug into the side, probably less than 10 feet apart. I took a look at them. The diameter is about the circumference of a 5-pound coffee can. One was somewhat oval-shaped, and the tracks looked something similar to what a fox footprint would look like. We're thinking that it's probably a badger because we've had issues with them before. And my question is, even if it's not a badger, how can we get them to move to another area without harming them or doing anything that we shouldn't do that, of course, we won't. So if you could help me on that, that'd be great.
Well, you know, I think the first thing to do is determine for sure that what you've got. Either animal would find a hillside overlooking an open area to be just a superb spot for denning. Especially fox. And you mentioned the oval hole. I mean, typically one of the differences you would see is that the badgers, being kind of a compressed animal looking oval in cross-section, would have a distinctively flattened or oval hole opening where it's a little more round with fox. But it doesn't seem all that large. The tracks... One thing you're going to notice with badger tracks, they've got incredibly long claws, and those should be very, very obvious in the tracks. Uh-huh. If there's any question about what you have and therefore what you might want to do about it or not do about it, somebody there who works with you is going to have a trail camera and uh-huh. just mount that trail camera overlooking the holes or den site and see what you've got. And then there'll be no question about it, and then you can decide how to respond. Either way, moving the animals, be it badger or fox, is going to be about the same issue. Either you've got to think about live trapping the animals or having some help doing that and then relocating them, or it may be as simple as an application. If the holes just seem to have appeared recently, an application in the area of some things that most mammals find offensive, one being naphthalene flakes or moth flakes, another being the scent of ammonia. Now, you don't want to necessarily soak the holes or whatever else, but if it's a new if it's a new excavation, just a sprinkling of these things around may be enough to cause them to relocate.
Okay.
The other consideration is that if it is badger, they may do a lot of excavating, just digging up a few ground squirrels or something that you want to get rid of in a park-like situation anyway, and they may have moved on their own. It may not be an attempt to establish a den site.
Okay, what if I fill those holes in to start with? Would that kind of give them some frustration so that they may think of moving?
Well, maybe, but it may irritate them a little bit. But a badger is such a superb digger that you know, they can reopen those burrows in pretty almost faster than you can fill them up. But again, if you're going to try that, it would be interesting and enlightening for future such competition to have that trail camera set up after you fill the holes and see what the response is.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Good luck.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
Sounds like fun. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate the call. Speaking of badgers, if folks haven't seen a badger, I know the Vilas Park Zoo.
Well, the new exhibit is,
has a new exhibit for the two badgers that they have. That's in Madison. And so if you're in the Madison area, the zoo is actually a free zoo. You can go right in, you don't have to pay anything, although they encourage folks to put a little money in the can on the way out. But it's a pretty spectacular new facility for the two badgers, so worth a look. Jack in Superior has something for us. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Just want to say that the night crawler thing happened last year. Almost all night crawlers were gone last year, and this year they're completely gone through the whole city. I live in the center about, and I walk three or four times a day all over the place, and day and night, and they are gone. Plus, the other smaller worms are almost completely gone, too. So I wonder what in the world it is. I've been doing a lot of digging, many bushels of dirt, and there are no night crawlers and very few of the other little worms.
But historically, on a rainy night, if you were wandering around, you'd see them all over the sidewalk.
And, yes. I've lived here 15 years, and they were here for 13 years. Last year, they're almost completely gone, day and night, and this year they are completely gone, day and night. There's nothing after a warm rain, after any rain. There's nothing. No night crawlers whatsoever. And I walk all over, day and night.
Interesting. Right. Interesting. Yeah, really. Well, I simply don't know, so I think Larry's going to have to do a little detective work here and invite an invertebrate zoologist on the show and explain what the situation was with worms. Ever since the release of information not too many years ago that, all of our earthworms are exotics and don't belong here anyway and so on and so forth, and that whole issue, I've kind of stayed away from the worm situation and either find what I can in my garden or buy them at the bait shop. So that's about all I can say about it.
That'd be worth looking into. Now it's the second person that's reported on that. We'll take a look. Jill says, yeah, we'll look into that.
I just wonder if the incredible rainy weather we've had maybe has something to do with it. But
it's certainly worth looking into. Thanks, Jack. Appreciate the call. Stephen Palmyra, you're next. Hi, Steve.
Morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I think it was the third week in August. My wife and I, it was late afternoon, early evening, observed a large flock. We've estimated between 80 and 100 big white birds flying southwest, pretty high, I would say a couple thousand feet. I think they were hoopers, although I've never seen a flock of hoopers that big flying. My wife seems to think they were a lesser eider. You guys have any idea what we saw?
Eiders. Yeah, I think they were white pelicans.
Yeah.
That was my first guess. And then we started pondering on it, and I decided hoopers, but she thought I was nuts when I said pelicans.
No, actually, I mean, you can see white pelicans just about anywhere now. I see them occasionally going over the house high up south of Madison, and there's been a small waterfowl production pond in the town of Oregon that over a fair chunk of the summers had 60 or 80 pelicans on it. So they're around, and they'd be the most likely, you know, short of a flock of snow geese, but it's too early for that. My guess is white pelicans. That's too many to be whoopers.
Okay, now snow geese, am I correct in assuming, do they have a yellow bill and yellow feet? Is that correct?
Let me think now. I don't think so. No, okay. I think it's more grayish, but I mean, at that altitude, I don't know what you're going to see anyway relative to the feet. Now, both of them are going to have black wingtips.
Okay. Yeah. No, I couldn't see their feet or their bills, but I've seen taxidermied snow geese, and they always seem to have a yellow bill and yellow feet. But so I was right in assuming the pelican. I've never seen them in the air before. I've seen them on the ground.
Well, they're very, very graceful flyers, and this time of year in a flock that size, that would be my number one guess.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot, Steve, for calling. Jill Nadeau, our producer, has put up your video of the bullfrog jumping at your stick.
Yes.
In the pond. If you joined us late, Scott had a bullfrog show up at his pond, and he has no idea where it came from. Started feeding it some night crawlers, and when he taps on the water, the bullfrog comes right over and will jump up on the jump at the stick and grab the night crawler if there's one there. And so we've got the video on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page titled "The Larry Mueller Show." There it goes.
There he went.
We're watching it right now.
It's only a 9-second spot. So.
It's a short spot. You're not going to have to sit and watch for hours for that frog to jump up. Believe me. And then below that, we've got a photo of the bullfrog that Scott took. So that's the Craven bullfrog. And I see there are some other nice photos as well.
Yeah, there's a nice blue-spotted salamander.
Yeah, there's a nice salamander, and there's a pretty good-sized buck.
Yeah, that's a nice buck, too.
As well. So we'll talk some more about that, and, of course, we'll take more of your questions at 1-800-642-1234. We're going to take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and we'll be right back with Scott. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Emeritus Professor Scott Craven from the University of Wisconsin Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. Great to have him along. Thanks for listening in. Martha in Kearney, Michigan, has been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Hi, Martha. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I like your show, Larry. I really do. I like all the different things you do on there. And I really have a kind of an interesting question today for you, this guy that you got on. We think we have bats in our house, in our peak, in our upstairs, and we'd really like to know how to get rid of them.
Well, first thing is it wouldn't be a surprise at all if you do have bats up there, but that's probably a seasonal issue, and you're rapidly getting to the point for this year where there's very little you could probably do about bat proofing. The normal solution to the problem is that you figure out how the bats are gaining access to the peak or dormer or roof or whatever it is, and then there are ways to treat those openings with bat excluders or bird netting such that the bats can get out, say, to feed in the evening during the warm part of the year, and then after they've all been, but they can't get back in, and then after they've been excluded, you take down the netting excluders or whatever and then seal the openings. And it doesn't take much to do that because the bats don't have the capability of chewing their way in or out like, say, a squirrel would. So it's an existing crack or break or missing soffit or vent or whatever that usually can be fixed.
What kind of droppings do they give off?
Their droppings are small, dark.
Kind of like a mouse?
A lot like a mouse, except blunt at both ends rather than pointed. Oh, and if you think you're seeing bat droppings, just collect a couple of dried ones. And wearing a latex glove or, you know, washing up carefully afterward, just crumble them up on a piece of white paper and look at them with a magnifying glass. And what you'll see are lots of little undigested bug parts, since that's all they eat.
Well, you know what? One thing that really puzzled me. Now, we've got a nice window there. And it seems like that window gets really dirty when those bats are flying around. You don't think they're urinating on that window, do you?
Possible urination, possible splattering of droppings, a whole host of possibilities. But the bottom line is, with a bat with a household bat colony, exclusion is the solution. Okay. But it's unusual for them to overwinter in the house.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that.
So you've got a period coming up where they won't be there. My suggestion is that you send some. This is maybe not a do-it-yourself project if it's a high peak, but get somebody up there to look around.
Okay.
After say the 1st of October, when they've probably left. And if there are any obvious openings, cracks, or anything else I described, seal those up. And it doesn't take much. It can be a little of this expandable polystyrene insulation, like great stuff. It can be a pad of steel wool. It can be a wad of bubble gum if you want. But anything to seal up every crack or crevice bigger than...
Size of a dime.
Well, size of a dime or even a crack 3/8 of an inch wide is enough to let the bats in. Seal that up and maybe you get lucky and the problem is solved for next spring.
But since you know what we've been doing? We've been putting a radio on real loud, kind of loud at night, and we have a light on. And I haven't seen anything since that. So I don't know if they're... But I hope that they're gone. You think they're You don't think they're still hanging around up there, hanging somewhere?
It depends. Where are you in Michigan? Lower Peninsula, Upper Peninsula?
Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, I mean, it's starting to get pretty chilly up there. As soon as you're not seeing insects anymore, or certainly after a frost or two, they'll clear out. But generally, unless it's just a small colony that was just hanging on, you know, a radio or the things you're describing really wouldn't be very effective.
Yeah.
But go ahead and it's only proper for insulation purposes to want to seal up anyway after it gets cold and see what happens. Now, the other issue is if you were in Wisconsin, then there are new regulations on how and when that kind of thing can be done to control a household bat colony because of the risks to our bats by white nose syndrome and other conservation problems. I don't know what the situation is in Michigan, but you might want to check that out with your local Michigan DNR office.
Yeah, good ideas. Good luck. Thank you, Martha, for calling. Appreciate your call. Judy in Racine has something for us. Hi, Judy.
Hi, I have another dropping question, if you're up for it. What do toads leave behind?
They leave behind toad droppings. Which are, now the interesting thing in that is that they're surprisingly large.
Oh.
Mm.
So you may find, you know, by the garage door or on or something at the next morning, what the heck is that big funny-looking dropping? That could be a toad.
Does it look like a small dog poop?
Yeah, well, really small dog.
Okay. I
mean, you're still, when I say large for an animal the size of a toad, but, you know, it can be, the dropping could be, you know, the size of the tip of your little finger.
Okay. And then the other question, the one I really called about before somebody mentioned droppings, and I thought of that one, why would a squirrel be carrying a bird in its mouth?
Well, I can describe that in only one word, lunch.
Yeah.
Squirrels will eat birds?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Really?
Squirrels, particularly, well, gray squirrels, ground squirrels. I had one of my class field trips out a few years ago. We were sitting around on the grass talking about something, and some fledgling sparrows were fluttering around that had just left the nest. And all of a sudden, out of the grass, a 13-line ground squirrel launched itself about a foot high like a little ballistic missile coming out of the ground, grabbed the bird, killed it with a single bite to the head, and dragged it away.
And oh, my goodness.
Gray squirrels will commonly, well, I shouldn't say commonly. It's not a major food source, but they'll certainly, if they come across a bird nest in a tree cavity that they're using or thinking about using or along a limb, eggs and nestlings are fair game.
One of our callers, this is some years back, was talking about her bird feeder where a squirrel would be coming in and taking a bird, one of the nest, the birds that were on the ground, just kind of walking and feeding along and then jump on the
bird. That I've not seen at my feeders, but it's certainly within the realm of possibility. Wow. But yes, squirrels can be predacious.
Thanks, Judy. Dave in Madison, hello.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. It's an honor to
be on the phone with the legendary Scott Craven.
Well, thank you, Dave. I'll send you your check in a couple of days.
See, I was hiking in a state park a couple weeks ago, and towards evening, and on the stairs along a waterfall, I saw what at first I thought was a house cat, and as I walked up closer, the critter scooted up a tree, and it turned out it was a little fisher, about the size of a gray squirrel. And I've also seen them by my cabin on the upper St. Croix, where, good gosh, they're so big they look like a wolverine. But my question about fishers is, are they really an efficient enough predator to take out porcupines, feral cats, and quiet our red squirrels down when you're on a deer stand?
Okay, so there's two parts to your question, Dave. First of all, an adult fisher, they're members of the weasel family. They are very effective predators, and a pie diagram of fisher diet includes just about everything you could think of that's found in northern Wisconsin. They'll eat just about anything, including killing porcupines, feral cats, and all the other things you mentioned. So they have a very diverse prey base, and they're very efficient predators. When you say gray squirrel size, though, that concerns me a little bit. Where did you see this animal? What county?
Well, I was actually up on in the Magny State Forest on the north shore of Minnesota.
Well, it's certainly possible that it's a young fisher, but when I don't know about the Minnesota situation, but the reason I was asking was because an animal a little above squirrel size that went up a tree also fits the description of an American marten, or formerly called a pine marten. They're quite rare.
He had the big fox-like ears. I was only maybe 8 feet away from him. Got a real good looking at him.
A marten, let me find this here. I'm looking at the cover of the Bridges magazine, which is the monthly or the quarterly publication of the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, and there was a nice article in it entitled "Have You Met the American Marten?" And as I look at that marten on the cover sitting on a birdhouse, it certainly has big fox-like ears. It's much smaller than a fisher, but otherwise very similar in body form and tail, and would do exactly what you said, and is a very efficient predator on red squirrels.
Yeah.
So, but I just don't know what the situation is up in northern Minnesota. They're quite rare after many years of recovery efforts in Wisconsin. Either way, you might have seen a marten, that's a long shot, or you may have just seen a younger fisher, but either way, they're both very efficient predators.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Dave. Jack in Neillsville, your turn. Hi, Jack.
Hi. You there?
Yeah, what have you got for us today?
Okay. Well, this last weekend, my daughter was walking down to the mailbox. We live in Anago, Wisconsin, Lang Lake County there. She's just south of Antigo, I don't know, old farmstead out there. She was walking to the mailbox with her big Labrador, and they treed a cougar. And I was just wondering how rare that is in Wisconsin. What do you think of that?
It's pretty unusual. Since I guess 2002, I think it was when the or 2000 and whenever the Milton cougar was finally determined to be actually a cougar through genetic testing, there have been one or two or three or four sightings a year, and they're tracked by some of my colleagues at UW Stevens Point. So they certainly do move through the state. Most are young males dispersing from the Black Hills area, at least that's what the genetics tell us, and they can just go through Wisconsin and move tremendous distances beyond Wisconsin. So it does happen. I mean, they're a really big animal, though. Is there? She's pretty sure that's what she saw?
Yeah. She she called the local DNR office. I don't know if that came out or not, but she had pictures of the paw prints, and I mean they're good, 5.5, 6 inches wide.
Okay, well then that's and it, you know they're as big around as a human handprint, and
yeah.
Well, it, bottom line is it's certainly. It apparently happened. It's certainly possible, but it's a rare event under any circumstances. So, pretty cool.
Yeah, pretty cool. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Jack. I just want to go to Facebook again for a minute because Joel sent a picture of a pretty good size white-tailed buck with a hump. He says it's on one side of the animal, and you can see that hump. Wondering what that possibly might be. It's
I think it's actually a camel, Larry.
Yeah, it looks almost like a camel.
Well, it's a big hump, and I'm guessing one of two things, either some type of a tumor that deer can be subject to, or some type of an injury that has healed itself and caused a lot of scar tissue, whether it was a broken upper part of the shoulder there, hit by a car, whether it was hit in a previous hunting season by an arrow or who knows what, and a variety of tissue has or fluid has accumulated there. I don't know. Those are just a couple of what are probably many more possibilities, but I have no idea. But it's clearly a deformation in that poor animal.
Yeah,
although
that's too bad.
It seems otherwise healthy and doing pretty well. They are tough animals.
And speaking of deer, we've got the hunting seasons here to talk about for a few minutes.
Oh, boy, there's a lot of stuff going on, Larry. You know, September 1st just passed last week, and that was the opener for the dove season and the early teal and goose season, so lots of stuff started there. Today was the opening day for the bear hunting season, and the people using bait or sitting over bait have first shot at the bears this year for a week, and then the then it's fair game for both the people using dogs and the bait hunters beginning in a week. So the bear hunting season will be open. Coming up another big weekend here, weekend after this, the archery deer season will open. Shortly thereafter is the youth waterfowl hunt. The youth deer hunt comes up in the second weekend in October. The duck season, I think, opens on the 24th, and then there's another big opener in mid-October with pheasant season and so on. So it's almost a constant opening of various opportunities during the Wisconsin hunting seasons. And the good news on all of that is that the outlook for most of these species looks pretty darn favorable. And duck populations are still very high, slightly down from last year. I think it was about 2% nationwide. But some popular species like mallards are still at all-time population highs continentally. The grouse population, which are a big deal here in Wisconsin, finally seem to have bottomed out and started the recovery in this 10 or 11-year cycle. So counts in the Northwoods and Central Forest area were up slightly. And that's great news. If this, in fact, is the case and the trend continues, we can look forward to increasingly good grouse hunting, which is extremely popular and important to the Northwoods economy, and just a great thing. So we can look forward to that for the next 5 or 6 or 7 years before they really tail off again. The deer outlook looks very good as that comes up. I think the postseason population from last fall was, you know, well over 1 million again. So there are a lot of animals out there, and with reproduction, a lot more than that. As you indicated, the bear season opened today, and there were a lot of permits doled out, a lot of interest in the permits, and something over 11,000 tags issued. So there'll be lots of people out there pursuing bears. Anybody interested in the upcoming deer season should do their homework before they get started and check out some of the regulations changes. There's a patchwork of holiday hunts available around the state. The availability of antlerless tags is still an ongoing concern. There is still some tags available. electronic registration seems to be here to stay. There are just lots of things for deer hunters to think about as people still get used to all the changes that were made in response to the Deer Trustee report just a few years ago. So,
lots
of things going on in the world of hunting opportunity. One of the things I just wanted to mention here, if I can find where the heck I put it, since I mentioned the archery season coming up, Pat Durkin, our outdoor communicator colleague, had a really nice article the other day about a new book on the history of bow hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, holy cow, I mean, bow hunting or archery hunting has come a long way since the first season in 1934. There were two counties open, 40 licenses, 40 were sold, and one deer was registered in 1934. Two counties, 40 licenses, one deer. Now, all counties are open. They're estimating about 230,000 licenses this year and estimating that 90,000 deer will be taken.
So, wow.
You know, that kind of thing's come a long way. And for folks interested in this, the book is entitled The History of Wisconsin Bow Hunting, 1930 to 2016, by Bill McCrary. So that would be a good read for those 230,000 people who are headed out.
And, you know, I was thinking, you were talking about the spread of deer and the spread of populations. Marty in Bayfield emailed to say he's seeing a lot of turkeys up in Bayfield. And there's, I think the population, you know, there was a little bit of a lull, but I think it's rebounding.
They took a beating a couple winters back, but they do seem to be rebounding. I'm still seeing them around the cabin in Price County. And, well, that's another thing. There are still permits available in some of the units for the fall turkey hunting season, which also opens on this weekend after this one coming up. And I also wanted to mention that apparently the DNR has about 75,000 nice, fat, healthy pheasants that they're preparing to stock on our public hunting grounds for the season that opens mid-October. And, boy, I enjoy driving past the Oak Hill Correctional Facility over in Oregon, where they have the big pens with the birds that are destined for stocking in Dane County around me. So the dog starts to get fidgety, and it's going to be time to go.
Pheasants and grouse. Boy, now there's some good, really good eating there for those. We'll talk about
next time I'm on, we'll talk about game cooking.
Yeah, that'll be a lot of fun. Scott and I have taught some wild game cooking classes and had a lot of fun with that. So we'll be posting some photos and maybe one of a newspaper story from 87, was it, Scott? That I forget now.
87 or 89. We'll see if we can get that picture of you. You haven't changed a bit, Larry, in 30-some years.
Yes. Glad to do that. And Sandy saw three bucks standing together, wondered if that was unusual. Sandy in Buffalo.
No, they haven't really split up and started charging around yet, so not, it's a nice thing to see, but not particularly unusual. Larry, if we can, I wanted to put a plug in for tomorrow, that afternoon broadcast. We haven't brought up the wolves,
and yes,
fortunately there's not time to bring it up now, except there's been a lot of concern over the last couple weeks since it was released that a record number of hunting dogs have been killed by wolves, and particularly in the northern part of the state. And our colleague Scott Hingstrom from UW Stevens Point is going to be talking about that on public radio tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah, so that's something to tune in. I think Veronica Rickard, I believe, interviewed him, or may have certainly been in on it. Anyway, it'll be on the afternoon show at some point. Well, here we are out of time. Here's a quick question. Canada geese interbreed with domestic geese? Not likely.
Probably not, but there have been some records and even some photographs of hybrids with other types of wild geese. But, boy, the domestic poultry issue is such and so confusing that even Canada geese held in captivity may not be pure animals. So that's hard to say, but not likely.
Scott, always a pleasure. We'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Scott Craven, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and with UW Extension. He'll be back in a couple months Next month, David Drake and Jamie Nack will be on the first Wednesday of the month to talk wildlife. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store.